too, or the topic of the workshop is literally, so they're going to be open problems, and they're going to be things where I say, well, I'm a mathematician, I have some idea of cryptography, but where the people working on protocols going to tell me, well, maybe we know this already, but maybe we don't know this. At least it's an open problem for me. I don't claim to state this is an open problem for the world. Before I can talk about open problems, I have to define what I think is the background. We all know Diffie-Hellman problems, we all know the discrete logarithm problems, so you've seen all those. Something which split around 6 years ago was the computation Diffie-Hellman problem, the decision Diffie-Hellman problem, so some people used to call it weak Diffie-Hellman problem and so on. So I've been digging a bit into literature, and it's quite amazing to find out. Thank you. Our names change. My topic is pairings, and we're going to see soon that there's a big difference between the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem and the computational Diffie-Hellman problem. Namely, assume we have a pairing, so there is a map between two groups, G1, G2, and I want to call GT. For the moment, these are abstract groups, and I assume they have all the same prime group order L. Later on, we're going to embed these groups into real-life applications. There is going to be points on all of the curves, and suddenly we have to find our group of order L inside a much bigger group. For the moment, we're just working with abstract groups, somehow nicely given those groups. Brief definition of what a pairing is. So it's a map which is linear in both arguments, in the first argument and the second argument. I'm writing the first two groups additively because the instantiations we know are coming from algebraic geometry, and there these groups are written additively. And the final one is written multiplicatively because it's going to be the multiplicative group in the final field. What we want is a non-degenerate map. It would be kind of boring to work with a map which always maps to the identity. And so we require that if we plug in all second arguments and it always gives one, then this is only possible if P is the unit element of the first group. What we're using in protocols is the fact that we can jump with scalars from the first argument to the second argument and to the exponent. Well, this is a consequence of having a linearity here and there, so we can just jump around. And given, in comparison to the normal DL problem, to normal groups, this gives us one more degree of freedom. And this is what allows the tripartite key exchange, this is what allows ID-based encryption. Pairings were around before protocols. Pairings were around as a means to attack. Particularly, there's the morph attack, and then for larger genus, the flywheel attack. Those are attacks which use a transfer from the first group to the GT, which in our case is going to be a subgroup of the multiplicative group of the fine field. It's rather easy to find out once somebody gives you the idea, hey, you have a pairing, what can you do? What you use is you have a DLP in the first argument, you have a generator P, you have some scalar multiple of that P. You plug those in as the first argument of the pairing, and since we know it's not degenerate, there must be some P prime so that E of P P prime is non-trivial. And then this gives us some G. We're working in prime group order, so these groups are cyclic, so this is a generator of a new group of the group GT. And this gives us a GH, which, as we see, is a power of the same G. How do we see this? Well, the P sub A is S sub A times P. Now I said we can jump from that position to the exponent, and there we are. So suddenly, we have transferred the DLP from the first group to the G sub T. And if we can solve it in G sub T, we get the S sub A. And, well, the S sub A is just the DLP in the first group. So the DLP in G1 is no more secure than GT. And that was an attack. It's not, I mean, now we talk about this as a transfer because we often try to balance the security of those groups. Back then it was an attack because people were using elliptic curves as the first argument and did not realize that for some choices this GT had far less security. Another consequence which was pointed out in the paper by Antoine Jouin and Kim Nguyen, was that we have an easy decision to Vinhauer problem, provided that the groups are the same, or that we know a map from the G1 to GT. So for simplicity, I'm saying the first groups are identical, and so we need that the pairing, self-pairing, is non-trivial. Then somebody gives us the decision to Vinhauer instance. So we're getting three scalar multiples of a base point and the base point itself, and I asked, is this a valid triple? Well, what we do is we plug them into the pairing, the two A1 and A2, and the possible Diffie-Hellman key, and well, we can just compare this. And this was the first instance of, well, the first realization of a gap Diffie-Hellman group. So the notion of gap Diffie-Hellman groups was out before, but, well, people just didn't know how to construct this, and then I think it was at the MSRI workshop, where Kim and you started chatting and said, well, actually, we know those things. We know this from curves, and we have the pairing. And suddenly, well, the whole industry started. And now the industry started becoming constructive. One can use the same map to construct systems. We can construct a tripartite key exchange. I guess you have all seen this. I guess you also have seen the ID-based encryption. Well, the property we're using is that we can feed in three scalars, two secret ones, two unknown ones, and one which only the person, the receiver, knows. So the A is the secret of Alice, and she doesn't know Bob's and Charlie's secret. Then there is parent-based cryptography and ID-based encryption. I've been going through some why we want this, and I'm always not sure whether we want this, but hey, it's a nice application of the curve, so I'm sure we want this. The interesting part is it's basically like Algamal, but in this case we can use the secret as a scalar here. So what we want to do is we want to hash the ID to be an element of the second group. So I'm writing it out here with two different groups. I need a hash map from arbitrary strings to G2. The public key is some secret scalar times the base point, and the base point was in the previous slide in G1. And then, if as a secret, only the trusted authority can compute this scalar multiple. And so, this is the key. It can be computed by the recipient because he knows his secret key. It can be computed by the sender because the sender knows K. But in each case, one of them is unknown to an attacker. Now, when does the result remain unknown to the attacker? We have a huge slew of security assumptions. We're going to see some more. That is going to be the point where I say, well, I'm just a mathematician, help me. Maybe you have a better view of how these arrange. Like Pascal yesterday in your talk, he had this huge diagram. So when I planned this talk, I had the idea of sitting down and browsing all crypto papers on pairings. Well, it was 2 a.m. this morning when I finally gave up, and I just said, well, I found this little piece, and it's by no means representative. I think it's quite a work for, say, a master's thesis to find out all the security assumptions we're currently working with and what applies which. So I'm behind what I wanted to do. The basic ones are the computational validity of Diffie-Hellman problem and the decisional validity of Diffie-Hellman problem, the direct analogs of the ones without Balinier. So this time we have three. And the question is, can somebody compute the tripartite key? Or can somebody distinguish the distribution of the proper key from some random powers? So much for what we want to have. Now, how do we get those things? As I said, they came up as attacks, and they came up as attacks, very concrete attacks, on proposed systems named loop-de-curve cryptography. The pairings we have at the moment, I'm not so familiar with the Kessel's pairing, which we're going to see on Friday. So I know the Tate and the Weil pairing, and they both use an abelian variety as the first argument. And particularly, we want to work with points of order L. So we want to have a prime order subgroup somewhere in our abelian variety. And for simplicity, I don't want to deal with k equals 1. I will assume that L squared does not divide the order over the ground field. If you're scared by what this means, then just think of an elliptic curve. And most of the talk are going to concentrate on what elliptic curves are. The more general setting is the divisor class group of degree zero divisors of some curve C. So this is the C, that is the degree zero. And PIC stands for Picard, which is the divisor class group. So what we are taking is the FQ rational points. So C is defined over FQ. And we're taking the FQ rational points which have order L. So here we go for an elliptic curve. You've seen that. And this is actually no more scary than that. That means we have now fixed our L, and we also have fixed the base field. Everything we're going to work in has something to do with FQ. And okay, Q is some power of a prime, so everything has something to do with FP. We're working in some extension of this FP, above that FQ, and we can't go to some other prime field. So when we're talking about subgroups over here, they must have something to do with FQ. And that gives us the first rotation, the embedding degree, which was on the blackboard this morning with Alice's talk. So we want to have a group of order L in G1, and a pairing must preserve the group structure. So we also need to have a group of order L in GT. Now GT is a part of the multiplicative group of FQ or some extension field. Now that means there needs to be a group of order L. And there's a nice theorem of Lagrange telling us, well, if L is a prime and there should be an element of order L or a subgroup of order L, then L must divide the group order. The group order of FQ to the K star is simply Q to the K minus 1. And so we get the requirement that L must divide Q to the K minus 1. And that's where this magic embedding degree comes from. We just take the minimal field, the minimal extension field of FQ, so that the L's rules of unity are defined over that field. And in most cases, which we're using for constructive Cocteau now, this K is larger than 1. So we don't have L's rules of unity in the ground field. We have to go to some extension field, FQ to the K, and work there so that we have the L's rules of unity. And for the attacks, this was nasty, because usually for a normal curve, this K is huge. And we just don't know how to work with that. And we wouldn't be able to work easier in FQ to the K star than on the elliptic curve itself. But it happened for supersingular curves, we're going to see that soon, that this K can be very small. And so suddenly there was a map from elliptic curve where we think we have exponential security to a finite field which was not much larger than the base field. And finite fields come with sub-exponential algorithms. We had the first talk here showing that we always have L of 1/3, definitely sub-exponential. And even if it would be only L of 1/2, it would be far less secure than elliptic curves. And so we can be happy that the embedding degree is usually very large, we want just elliptic curves, or moderately large, or we can at least get it large for pairing-based systems, because that is the balance between an exponential security and a sub-exponential security in a larger group. Well, actually, it's not the group which increases, but the field size. But all the sub-exponential algorithms in the fine field, they work with the field. These are Enkel-Skylar attacks. And we don't know how to speed them up by using a subgroup. So we are embedding our small group of order L into a bigger field. And the Enkel-Skylar looks at the big field, whereas the Topol-Gerow and so on look at the subgroup. And we have to have the boson secure. Now, one before last slide with PIC. After that, I'm going to have elliptic curves. Until at some point I reach hyperelliptic curves, how can you expect me to do talk without hyperelliptic curves? At least those who are at ECC know that I'm very much supporting hyperelliptic curves. And so here we go. We have the points of order L by the classes. Now, this is a class, so it gets a bar over here. If you're on a curve, this is just isomorphic to some point. The fact that this is a point of order L, a divisor class of order L, means that if I take L times, the point on the elliptic curve, this will be zero. From the way we construct the these elements. We're working with divisor classes. And there we know there is some function f depending only on this d1, so that L times d1 is isomorphic to the divisor of this function. If you have never seen divisor classes, you're going to have an example for loop decurves, and I'm going to do it on the blackboard to make it slow. Anyway, so there is always some function. If I'm giving a function, I can evaluate the function. Now here is my function again, evaluated at some pi and qj, which comes from the second input. Again, we have a divisor class, and we take a representing divisor. Now, the support are the points appearing in d1 and d2. And if that would be the case, then there would be roots or poles of f, and so suddenly would have a zero up here or a zero down there, which would give us a very boring value. And so we require that the subplots are disjoint, and it's a bit of fiddling to show that this is always possible. So, well, this is the Tate-Lichtenbaum pairing. How do we do this? Or what does it buy us? It buys us that we get a bilinear map which is non-degenerate on the L torsion points. The second input, you often also see the L torsion points. If you look into the definition, actually is the group modulo L times Q. That is like Z mod L Z. It's nothing scary. You just take the group and then you take the L times the group organized. Everything which is L times something gets mapped to the identity class. And we end up in the finite field. And now if we would have an L float here, it would be zero. So everything which is the L float here is an L to power over here. And so they must map to the unit class. And so we end up in this. Now, if you've seen ID-based encryption, if you've seen Jupyter key exchange, you want to use the result. It should be one element which you can then use as a key for your symmetric encryption. So you don't want a class, because the class always says, hey, you've got this representative, and this representative, and this, 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 and this. It's not unique. And if you want to use this for crypto, you have to go for a unique element. And that's why people talk about the modified Tate pairing. There is a canonical isomorphism of this group with a group of L roots of unity. And you can achieve this canonical representative by computing the Q to the K minus 1 over L power. Now, if you want to speed up systems, you don't like to see this piece. But you only need to get to a unique representative in the very moment where you use it. So if your protocol requires several pairings, which are then multiplied whatever, all these operations are behaving nicely with respect to the classes. So only at the very end, when you really need the class, you compute once, I mean, when you need the representative of the class, you compute this exponentiation once. Or if you want to compare the two classes, you just divide the representing elements and then compute the power and ask, is this one? So most of the times, you only need one exponentiation to go to those two. Now, as promised, elliptic curves. So for elliptic curves, this monster, this Picard group, is just isomorphic to the points of the curve. And so we can define a pairing on points rather than divisor classes. And if you've seen how elliptic curves work, then everybody draws to this picture. You might ask, if this is my point P, how do I double my point P? Well, then people say, you draw a line, you find a point, you draw another line, and you find your result. This point we call 2 times P. And if you're now out for optimizing the speed of the scalar multiplication, you throw away the lines and you try to get no memories of this line. Yes, you somewhat compute them if you remember how you once drew out the formulas and you remember, oh yes, it's lambda which appears in the formulas. That's actually the slow one. But no recollection of the mu, which is the intersection here. Now, for computing this function f suddenly need to remember the functions. For high-velocity curves, there are similar functions which are not lines, but say cubics, or generally functions of degree 2 times the genus 1 is 1. But for elliptic curves, we just have lines. Let's call this line line L. This is not an L, this is not a prime, but this is an L. And this is a vertical line. Thanks, but I was just going to change here. But yeah, that's a good line.
Actually fine.
Okay. Is this still readable?
Yeah.
Works really well, yeah.
Okay, thanks. So, the modest thing about the definition as I've given it so far is that it's impractical. I'm going to build a huge function. I mean, first of all, we don't know how to get this function, but if you would, it would have a huge degree. And we get this function only to evaluate it at one point, or at g points, if you have a larger genus. So, what Miller observed is, well, if we do a scalar multiplication, we do the double and add algorithm. And if you do the double and add algorithm, we always compute these functions. And it's very easy to compose these functions to build the big function. And here we go. So what we do is, well, we want to have something L times a point. And we know before L times a point is going to be the point infinity. But on the way to compute this known result, we're going to need many, many functions. And these are exactly the functions which we want to have. So when we double the point, we start with some p. So the first step is we initialize our intermediate point t to be p and the function to be 1. Nothing happened. Then we get the function, the connecting line and the vertical line, by doubling this t. And what happens to the function? The function would be squared and then multiplied with the line by the divisor. So the function as function of x, y would be updated to x squared times L divided by b. So exactly those lines come in. This is just a degree 1 polynomial. This is just a degree 1 polynomial. And so in each step, for each doubling, we would square. So we'd get a 2 times 2 to the power log L, so exactly degree L, which is kind of huge. It's 2 to the 160 at least. And, well, divide here. Much nicer to evaluate it right away. And so that's what we do. We take the two input points, so Q, which was shifted by some R to have a disjoint support, and in the denominator, the negative part, which before was Q minus the point infinity, we have shifted by this R, so we now have Q plus R and minus R. So the minus part sure changes the order, and so that's what's happening with your doubling. Next step, we look at the coefficient, if it's 0, then we go to the next doubling, nothing else in double and add. If it's 1, we have to add. So then we find our point here, we draw the connecting line, hope that it meets the tape, but it meets in 1 point, exactly in 1 point. We find this one, we map here, we get 3 times t. And here's the way how we update the function. So all this big thing with the function has boiled down computing lines and evaluating a line at a point. Now, because we're going to use this soon in the speed-ups, the vertical line has the form x equals some constant. This line has the form y equals lambda x plus some mu, but this one is just involving the x. You have heard a lot of super singular curves, lots of ordinary curves. So what's the definition of a super singular curve? Instead of one definition, I give you three and say all these three definitions are isomorphic. If you get equivalent, if you get one, here's the others. So if you want to look at the points of some order p, where p is the characteristic, so we're working over if q is some power of p, then You can either look at the points of order P and find out this is just the point infinity, or you can look at the trace, find out that the trace is congruent to 0 mod P, or you look at the endomorphism ring. Well, and the endomorphism ring usually is an already quadratic number field. In the supersingular curve, it's a quaternion algebra, so it is a high dimension. And this is going to be important for distortion maps soon. So here you see this as some extension degree. And actually one can prove if it holds for one S, then it holds for any S. So the easiest is usually you look at just some S. So for instance, for this example curve, that's a curve over a binary field, and so we would be interested in points of order 2. Now, if it would have a point of order 2, it would be equal to its own negative. For a curve of this shape, the negative, well, it's not minus b, because we encounter stick 2, but it's b plus 1. It's always plus whatever is here. And so the negative of point ab is a comma b plus 1. If those points were equal, well, the first coordinates coincide, fine. For the second coordinate, we would have that b equals b plus 1. And there is just no such thing. And so there is no point of order 2. So the two torsion points, so s equals 1, is just the point infinity. That's one of the possibilities. Or we see that the number of points is even. Each point that comes of affine points is even. Each affine point, we have a different inverse. So for each point, we get another point. And then there's point infinity. So in total, we have an odd number. And if we now look at the number of points q minus the trace plus 1, then the trace must be even, which was another criterion for supersingularity. So why do people care about supersingular curves? Well, first of all, they started caring about them because they were proposed for cryptosystems. And oops, suddenly one could break systems. As you're going to see later, they have a small embedding degree. Another thing is, for protocols, they're kind of nice because they allow some map from the points of order L over FQ to another group over an extension field. So for all our protocols, we always have a map. It would be nice to have a map from G1 to G2. Then in the two-butterfly key exchange, we can save half of the work. In many protocols, the analysis gets much easier. And surprisingly, very often this distortion map is used in the proofs. It doesn't appear in the protocols, so you think, ah, well, we can just run it, but it appears in the proofs that you have a map from one to the other. So, for supersingular curves, we find such maps which map, well, the Tate pairing itself, if you evaluate the P and P, and K is larger than 1, you get 1. That's very boring. We didn't want to have that. But what we can do is we use a map from the group over the ground field to the extension field. For instance, if we have this type of curve, and if I give you a point x, y, and 3 congruent to p congruent to 3 mod field means that there is no square root of minus 1 at the ground field, but there's always 1 over the quadratic extension field. So I is not actually an fp, but an fp squared. And so if we plug it in here, we plug in minus x, okay, both exponents are odd. And so if I want to change the sign here, I have to multiply y with I. While this point was over the ground field, this point is over a quadratic extension field. Now, if the first point is order L, then also the resulting point is order L. Those are cyclic groups and they're disjoint, because this one stays in the ground field, this one stays in the extension field. And so I found a way to map from the first group to the second group. And it's actually an extremely cheap one. I mean, just flipping the sign here, and this is one multiplication of the ground field. And there are other cases, so this is again multiplication by a root of unity. For binary and ternary curves, it gets a bit messy, but it's still, you can write them down. So for all the supersingular curves, we Now people started to ask, first, what can we do with them? I said before, it's very convenient to write the protocols. It's also convenient in the protocols to start with a scalar multiplication of the smaller group. Now I said before, we want a large k. So computations over q to the k are going to be much more expensive than computations over fq. And so all the operations we can do over the smaller fields save us work. So for instance, in the tripartite key exchange, I would do all the exchange and everything over the small field. And then when I want to evaluate the parent, I apply the distortion map on one of the input points of the second one. And then I have to work over fq and over fq to the k for the scalar multiplications over the ground field. And well, for the first example which I showed you with the minus 1 and the I, this means that the x coordinate remains in the same field it was before, and the y coordinate goes to a quadratic extension field. I already stressed here that the vertical line only takes into account the x coordinate. We're going to see one easy speed up, which is based on this fact that if you have a point which has x coordinate over the ground field, y coordinate over a larger field, then you can skip some inversions. So again, computational advantages. It's easy to state the systems, and well, short signatures were nicely proposed in this setting. So you want to map your hash function maps into the G1, which we're actually going to use as the second argument. Your secret key is some S, your public key is S times P, and then the comparison is S times P with the hash. So this is the public key with the hash of the message, and the base point with the signature. Why short signatures? Well, if you have x and y, Alice showed this morning that you can always remove the y coordinate, just keep one bit. So you just have one point, which is the base point. This is the base point of the system. This is your public key, which is known. So the signature consists just of one x coordinate, whereas an algo model would have to transmit one point and one x coordinate. So it's gotten shorter. Now, ordinary curves. I said before, for all the supersingular curves, we find them. That has something to do with this endomorphism ring. And, well, here we have an order in a quadratic number field. Those things are commutative. So whatever two endomorphisms you give me, I can just change the order. And one very famous one is the Frobenius endomorphism. You know the Frobenius from the ground field. Take an element and commute it to the power of q. Now the Frobenius on the elliptic curve does the same but with the two coordinates. And if the curve was defined over q, then also the Frobenius of a point, x to the q, y to the q, is again over the ground field. So we have one endomorphism. And well, if I look at this, I know something about the structure. This is over the algebraic closure, or better, over fq to the k. I know that the fourth L torsion group is defined. Usually, I only have this part over the ground field, and for this part, I need fq to the k. Then you might wonder, is it easy or hard to find these elements? Now, since we know the Frobenius is operating here, we can look for eigenvalues, eigenvectors of the Frobenius. If I say I take a point over the ground field, then the Frobenius doesn't change it. Ground field means x and y over fq. Fq has a property that each element to the power of q gives the same element. So the Frobenius of the point equals the point. And so, well, any base point has eigenvalue 1 is an eigenvector of the Frobenius. But that's not enough, that only gives us L points. Now we go to the extension, we go to the fq to the k, and then we find more points. In total, we have L squared points of order L. And the canonical choice would be to take the trace 0 subgroup. That are points q, where the trace, so q plus the Frobenius of q plus to the power of k minus 1 of the point, gives a point of infinity. Those points, well, if I apply the Frobenius, then I get q, the sigma of q, this one. I get sigma square of q, sigma square of q, this one. finally I get sigma to the k of this one, which is q. So these points are apparently invariant under the Frobenius. What happens to them is, well, they're mapped. They are invariant under the Frobenius in the sense that the trace is invariant. Oops. The eigenvalue is times q times the base order. So we have one eigenvalue 1, one eigenvalue q, and this q, which is in the trace zero subgroup, is a generator of this other group. So if we have these choices p and q, then both of them are fixed under the Frobenius. The Frobenius does not map from one to the other, and we know that they all are commuting with the Frobenius. So there is just no anamorphism which gets us from here to there. So if these are our inputs to the pairing, then there is no distortion. Now I want to fix my G1 to be in the ground field, but there is no need to take G2 only general by Q. I can take some linear combination of P and Q, provided that B is non-zero. This is linearly independent. And then the trace, which I just used, the trace zero subgroup, will now be non-zero. So now I take the trace of this guy, Q, that will be mapped to zero, and P was invariant with the trace, so I just get K copies. And unless I was utterly stupid and got either A or K equal to zero, which I shouldn't, or equal to L, then this is non-zero. And it's linear independent of that. So the two groups I choose would be G1, like above, and G2, this one. And I get a map from G2 to G1. The first introduction of distortion map was from the smaller field to the bigger field. But for other protocols, well, we don't get short signatures. The signatures would be in FQ to the K. But still, it would be, well, just one element. We would have one canonical map from G2 to G1. So we also call such maps distortion maps. There's a nice paper by Stephen Goldress and Victor Roger. Which I'm going to cite later in the context of pairing assumptions, where they go through all the possibilities of which curves appear and how to get the distortion. Now, efficient computations, how do we get those things to work? These are some speedups which are described here for elliptic curves, unless they only work for hyperelliptic curves. Whenever they work for elliptic curves, they also work for hyperelliptic curves. If you find something which is not here, then I'm either ignorant or this is an open problem to find it faster. So this is, to the best of my knowledge, the state of the art. So if I have this point R, remember this R came in the elliptic curve when I shifted away from to have disjoint support. I didn't want to have the P infinity there, but used some R. If I use R in the ground field over FQ, and I have a K which is larger than 1, and I use this finite smoothization, which we will do in the protocols anyway. So this maps everything which is an L's power to 1. Now, in a subfield, any element which is not defined over the big field from a smaller field, that will be mapped to 1. And so all the contribution of R, the L of R, and V of R, that goes in multiplicatively, goes in as a multiplication by 1. So if I would just take the result, I would see all these multiplications by input from R. I raise it to the power q to the k minus 1 divided by L, and all those inputs give 1. Now I know this before, so I can just remove all this computation. In general, whenever you multiply with an element which is from a smaller field, and this goes in multiplicatively, you can skip the computation. Also, well, we can just skip the evaluation at the second component. We can just work with Q here. Next step, if neither, if the protocol allows, and I should say if K is even, then we can have this situation that X is in the ground field, whereas Y is in the extension field. And so we can skip the computation of mu of Q. So then all the big Miller thing, the square F, well, we still have of r, gone. Divide by L of r, gone. Divide by V of q, gone. So we just have reduced four evaluations and multiplication of divisions to one. That's a nice beta. And well, for hyperelliptic curves, instead of working with points, you can work with divisor classes. Then there are some improvements to the speed of Miller. Now we get to the point, before I had, okay, I need k even, but that's still very generic. Now we get to the point, I hope that the L is such that some multiple, not too large multiple of it, has a low Hamming weight. Depending on what you start with, this is a rather rare case. But well, if so, then we have a nice mathematical relation between the pairing with L and the pairing with N, if we pay attention to the right exponents here. Then we can, instead of using a binary double end, we can reduce the weight by using enough expansions. So each time I have to add, there's another evaluation coming in. So low Hamming weight is good, or pre-computations is good. For supersingular curves, there are such cases where such an end with low Hamming weight exists. Plus, supersingular in small curves, that you always have a very fast doubling or tripling formula. So there we actually have even better than just a step and a half. Special curves. Well, one of the first papers on hyperelliptic curves was by Ivan Dosman and Ian Lee, where they looked at one particular type of hyperelliptic curves. Namely, they relate the prime to the genus. Well, for instance, if the genus shall be 2, then you want to have p equal 5. So if you have a quintic curve, then this is rather fast. And they found a way how to shorten this Miller loop. So Miller goes log L steps. And sometimes you can fold up those things. Well, okay, these curves are super singular, and they're very, very special. And then there are generalizations of this trick to the eta pairing and the eta t pairing. And even more recently, so the eta t pairing was the Tate pairing reverted. And now the 8 pairing is the shortened reverse Tate pairing. So naming it is a fun. We also have an analogous thing to the GLV curves. So GLV, you might know, is use of endomorphism to speed up scalar multiplications. For ordinary curves, you can use such endomorphisms as well. Special divisors, now we come to things that only work on hyperelliptic curves, where it gives us a speed up. So assume you're giving a divisor class, then usually you have a big divisor class. And for each point in your divisor, representing divisor, you have to evaluate all these functions. So in the elliptic curve case, I just said, reduce it to evaluating at one point. In the genus G setting, this was corresponding to, with all the improvement, evaluating at G points. Unless you go for special choices. And what we showed is that such special choices are possible. So it has been suggested as a basis for the L system by Kataki, Zemura, Ishita, and Takagi to just use a point minus the point infinity. Usually would have g different points here. And we use the same for pairing systems. As a second input, we hope, well, we get a speed up by a factor of g in that part, and what we show is that we still have a non-degenerate pairing. So for protocols, that is a point where I say I'm a mathematician, we show we hash to something, we can efficiently hash there, and, well, the domain where we hash to is large enough. On the other hand, the security protocol assumes that we map exactly to the group. Where we hash to is something which is isomorphic to a group of order L. I don't know how much the security proofs go wrong there. So what we can offer is a faster pairing. Now is the question, can we actually use it? We don't have any, say, like very easy breaking. We don't have a too small domain, or we don't have any apparent weakness, but the standard protocol proofs don't carry through now. That might be the case because it's insecure, or it might be because the protocol proofs are not optimal. The nice thing is we suddenly found something where the speed up grows with the genus. So for large genus curves, where, yeah, it's nice, give the mathematicians some toys to play with. Now we suddenly have something which gets faster with growing genus. Well, genus sounds scary because we know that there are sub-exponential algorithms when the genus grows too fast. On the other hand, in the situation which we have here, we have to balance the curve group with a finite field. And so in most cases, we work with a curve group which is larger than we want because we can't get a large enough k. And then suddenly, the security on the curve side is just fine, even for genus 4. Genus 4 just means we need to increase the size of the group, but we would do this anyway. And genus 4 gives us a nice speed up of factor 4 here. So, yeah, that's one of the open problems which are going to appear in a few slides. Look at, say, genus 4 or genus 5 case, find out what the trade-off is, how fast is this. I think it's just sitting down and doing it, so basically a master thesis, but we didn't have the time to do it. Mm. The embedding degree already announced this is the important parameter for balances security. And for instance, if we have a curve over a prime field where the prime is larger than 5, then we know by Hess's theorem that the trace is less than 2 times the square root of p. Then the supersingularity means that the trace is divisible by p and so equal to p, because p is larger than 2 times the square root of p. That means we have an easy way of stating the group order, and since p plus 1 always divides p square minus 1, we know that the embedding degree, so the smallest integer dividing p, so that L divides p to the k minus 1, well, L divides this part, so L also divides that part, and unless L also divides p minus 1, we have embedding degree 2. It can also happen that we have embedding degree 1. So as soon as we have supersingular over a large prime field, we are stuck with embedding degree 2. Not nice. If we have smaller other characteristics, so characteristic 2 or characteristic 3, in the old Mendes and Venstone paper, they show embedding degrees at most 4 and 6. There are curves for these things, and well, we've seen this morning how one can construct supersingular abelian varieties which have a larger security parameter. But if you want to play only elliptic curves, then this is the best you can hope for. If we look at the parametric recommendations, then it's, well, many people suggest elliptic curves 160 bits. That is, I would say, the bottom. Don't go below it. Rather go above it. A comparable size of q to the k is 1024 bits, and so the optimal embedding degree would be 6.4. Well, with supersingular we can only achieve 6. 6 is nice because it's even, so we can play all those tricks with exponents and so on. But elliptic curves of security is exponential, so the growth in the field size is much smaller than on the finite field size. So if you want higher security, the embedding degree has to be higher if you want to have optimal sizes on those sides. Now elliptic curves and also genus 2 curves don't give us more than a security parameter of 6. So, well, go away from supersingular curves or go to supersingular abelian varieties, but if you want even larger, then we're stuck. We can't get those with supersingular. Plus, well, if you paid attention in the very first talk, we had these different constants in the L of 1/3 algorithm. For prime fields, the number field sieve is much harder, is slower than for small characters for finite field sieve. And so extension degree 6 case is actually in a bad case. And also for genus 2, the embedding degree 12, so security parameter 6, is achieved for characteristic 2, which means we have the fast compressiveness methods. Protecting in these cards. So there's a nice paper by Dan Page, Nigel Smart, and Philippa Cautrin, where they do an analysis and comparing the sizes of what happens. And their result is, well, no good for supersingular small characteristic. So what else is there? There's MNT curves, named by Miyagi, Nakagashi, and Takano, who were the first to come up with a method of constructing curves which have a small embedding degree and are non-supersingular. I remember back then, it was before the time where we were looking for pairing-friendly curves. That was a time where pairings were bad. And I got this paper and said, yeah, sure. I mean, Moth does not say only super singular curves are bad. It just says super singular curves are bad, and please always pay attention to the embedding degree. And so I saw this paper and didn't realize that this was the foundation of a whole series of papers. And suddenly that now we want curves to be small embedding degree, but not too small. Well, people have been using those ideas, and now in much more generality, so going up to extension degree 12 or 10. So again, very nice to preach to the audience. Michael Nierich is here, David Friedman is here. So we have families of curves for those embedding degrees. And we can also handle curves where we have a small cofactor. So the early papers needed a prime group order, and they were kind of sparse. Now we're doing cofactors, we're doing embedding degrees up to 12. This is for elliptic curves. For hyperelliptic curves, this is still the problem. Now, what are the nice things of supersingular and ordinary? Well, for supersingular, we know how to get one. That's easy. And for supersingular, we can hope for a multiple which is having a small hanging weight. That is something related to the Frobenius being a power, being a root of an integer. So this relation with speed up is very, very unlikely to hold with four ordinary curves. And all the other things like the eta t pairing and the 8 pairing are specific to supersingular curves. On the other hand, well, we have the obvious drawback with a small k, and we only get the big k for a small characteristic. So that's not nice. Plus, people are always getting scary if curves are too special. Now, well, these curves are somewhat special anyway, but people are more scary the more special that things get. The ordinary case, well, we can have a big prime field. That's nice for software implementation. It's much faster to work with prime fields than binary fields. And we can achieve higher embedding degrees. So if you now want the new NSA curves with 512 bits, and you are crazy enough to want the 512 bits with pairings, then okay, go and buy a k equals 30. We don't have k equals 30 when we're working on it, so we will find something where even 512 bits finds its partner on the fine field side. Not that I want, but okay. It's a nice mathematical exercise. On the other hand, well, the default choices don't come with distortion maps, and we can't use many of the speed ups. So far, the area where I'm kind of comfortable is open problems are speed up the computation even more. Maybe I've overlooked some things, then let me know. Or if you find something, also let me know. Find more MET curves, say large embedding degrees or more families. Now, hyperelliptic curves, we still don't have cases of MET curves other than the trivial ones with CM modules of unity. And, well, I'm personally interested in the genus 4 trade-off case. There is a great collection with by Paolo Barreto. It's currently kind of out of date, but he says, well, he's working on it, and Michael is supposed to work on it. Now everybody stares at Michael, then he is feeling enough pressure to actually do it. So actually, stay tuned, there will come something. Sure, there's nice thing of, can you break the system? Now, in the last plus 1 minute.
We started a bit late. Okay,
thanks. What did we meet on the way? We met the decisional degree Hellman problem. Now, we saw that the DDH problem is easy to solve if I have a distortion map. That was the beginning of the whole story. And now we know when we can find the distortion map. Namely, well, we had this P, we had this Q coming in, and if there's a super singular curve, then we always find the distortion map from G1 to G2 mapping to the extension. If G is ordinary and we're given the DDHP in the G2, so over Q to the K, then it's easy again, because then I can use the trace of this element, so I have a default way of mapping from there to the element's generally collected trace, which is nicely taking care of all the scalars here. If I'm starting with G1 equals P, and I'm on an ordinary curve, this point was supposed to be out there, and the ordinary point was supposed to be this. So these last two points are about ordinary curves. Then I'm having my G1. Now I could artificially try to fill it up to end up in such a G2. But but I'm not able to produce the proper multiples of Q corresponding to the DDH problem, unless I'm able to solve the DDH. So there's just no way, or I don't see any way to get from G1 to this and then use a trace. And similar, the G2, that was a trace zero subgroup, so then this map just gives you the trivial result. And so again, no distortion map. This was linked in a paper, which I've been citing before by this Stephen and Victor. Oops, that happens with two fast cut and paste. Stephen, not Stephen. They actually started off by studying the co-Diffie-Hellman problem. So you're giving two groups, and I'm giving you two distributions. Well, you're supposed to distinguish these two distributions. I'm giving you either multiples which are linked by the same scalar, or I'm giving you some A here and some C here. If I have a distortion map, then I can map this to the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem. So then, in all these cases, let me go back one slide. So for instance here, if I'm giving a DDH here, then I can map this to the other problem, or vice versa. So there is an intense relation between the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem and the co-Diffie-Hellman problem, as soon as I have distortion maps. If I don't have distortion maps, then we don't know how to solve either of the two. So that is actually their study. They start off saying, okay, co-DDH has been proposed. How do we do this? And how much does it help to have distortion maps? Then there is one which always surprised me to see in papers. And this is, I mean, there's a huge slew of assumptions. That was what I started off saying. I tried to get it systematic and I didn't. This is one which is widely accepted by now. The Q-strong Diffie-Hellman assumption is comparing to the Q-strong, the strong RSA assumption. Somebody gives you not only one scalar group, but a ton of them, of the second point, and asks you to come up with a related scalar multiple of the first point, where you can use whatever x, but you have to know your x. And again, it's with the two groups. I don't think it's getting much easier if somebody gives a distortion map, but at least it would help you to get from all those P2s to the P1s. Nigel Smart in his talk at ECC was going through all the different groups, so he was actually working with the DDH sub I and JK assumptions. Because, well, we always have the G1 and the G2, and we could be given distributions in one of the two groups. Well, the classical DDH problem is just in one group. So I, J, and K is the same. All points are from the same group. But like the co-Diffie-Hellman problem, I'm given distribution in two groups. And so Nigel has a paper on this, which is to appear in Discrete Applied Mathematics. You can just get it from him, where he's going through all the possible security assumptions. And the nice part of it is, so he's been doing, for one special case named for ID-based signatures, he's been sitting down and looking at the systems, looking at, oops, so I don't see any distortion map here, but then I flip and see suddenly there is a distortion map. Now, how much do I need this distortion map, and what happens if not? And he's splitting what I've been doing before into four cases. So he's having the super singular, we always have a distortion map that's very trivial, and then he has the case where you have an ordinary curve, and you have these standard groups, you have the eigenvalues, 1 and Q, those two subgroups, or you have the mixed case where you have A times P plus B times Q, or you choose a second argument, the big group. Now, that sounds very tempting, and actually that's what we're doing in our paper, but the trouble is sometimes the protocol requires you to do membership testing. We just say, well, this is isomorphic to a group of order L. But then you can't do membership testing. Somebody gives you two elements and wants to know are they in the same subgroup, and I don't know. So he's going through all those assumptions and finding out that, well, do some advertisement for himself. So he's finding out that only his IP-based system does fit with ordinary curves. All the other ones, at least the security groups given, do not work with ordinary curves. Then the last slide would have been the pairing inversion problem. And the pairing inversion conversion problem is I give you elements on the GT, and depending on which paper you read, either you have fixed P or Q as one of the inputs, or you can choose one of those. Can you come up with a map from the pairing side, from the GT, to either G1 and or G2, so that the pairings have one element fixed? So for instance, can you come up with, I give you a Z, and you choose a P, then you know how to find Q, such that Z equals the pairing of P with Q. Now, if you could do this for any Q, then you could at least solve the DDH over here. Particularly if you have a distortion map, you can flip them. That was studied in depth by Verheul, and it's also in your overview article on at ENDS. So it's a nice thing, and my first impression when I saw the pairing inversion was, maybe that's a good way of attacking pairing, start with something easier. On the other hand, if you could solve pairing inversion, then you could break Diffie-Hellman in the fine field side. So it's not clear that that is an easier problem. It might even be a harder problem. So far, the only papers on pairing inversion that I know is a paper by Sato at WCC05, and a preprint by Como Hegarty, Stephen Galbraith, and Caroline Chidi, where they try to get a multivariate approach. So pairing inversion problem is something where we feel comfortable with basic protocols on, but, well, I think it deserves to be more studied, and my feeling is it should be better, or should be possible to prove the security rather than to